Welcome back. I'm Laura Noonan, the FT's US Banking Editor, and I'm going to be hosting you for the next hour or so. I've done quite a few panels on women in finance over the years, and I usually look into the audience and find a sea of women in finance looking back at me. With this event being virtual, I can't tell if that's the case again today, but I really hope there are some men watching out there, because common sense tells me what studies have shown, that meaningful progress on gender diversity is much more likely if it's driven by as wide a group as possible, which means both men and women coming to the table. In that vein, I'm delighted that I do have both men and women joining me virtually to talk about ways to get everyone behind a gender diversity push that can benefit businesses and societies as a whole. We have Jill Zucker, a managing partner at consultancy McKinsey & Company, Tiernan Brady, Global Director of Inclusion at law firm Clifford Chance, Heather Lord, Global Head of Strategy and Innovation at investment management firm Capital Group, and Robin Shepherd, Head of Corporate Engagement at hedge fund Bridgewater Associates. Thank you all very much for joining us today. I know that these are topics you all have strong views on, so maybe you could start us off by sharing whether you agree that men should be part of the conversation, and if you do, what's the single best thing companies can do to encourage men to come to the table? Jill, maybe you could start us off.
Sure, thanks Laura, I'm delighted to be here with everyone on this panel. Absolutely, men should be part of the conversation. It's a business imperative to have a diverse workforce, and leadership, unfortunately, at this moment is only 22% of the C-suite is occupied by women. And so if we say it's a business imperative, businesses have better performance when they have a diverse workforce. We need 80% of the leadership, which is men at this moment, to take real responsibility for this alongside all the women. So I'm delighted to be on this diverse panel today.
Okay, thank you very much. And then Tiernan, you are a man, so I guess you bring a unique perspective to this panel. You obviously do think it's important that men are involved, but how can firms get men coming to the table? How did your firm get you to come to the table?
Well, I mean, I suppose I came from a campaigning background, so I had worked on the marriage campaign as director in Australia for LGBT people. If LGBT people were depending on only themselves to get equality, of course we'd still be waiting. You know, this is a journey that's supposed to be for everybody. And if we can't engage people, then, you know, the thing that I really think that tries to do, if we concede that this is important, which I presume we all will, you know, how do we activate men in this space? And I think a lot of our firms are filled with good men who totally would be horrified at the idea that they were discriminating, but live in a world that is unfairly structured. And so how do you convince them that as long as your value is locked in your head and you're not demonstrating it every day, then it's a secret and you're not creating any change? You know, if you believe in equality, if you believe in fairness and inclusion, which I believe the vast majority of men hopefully do, you have to actively demonstrate it. It has to be more than just a value you think about, because the women in your firm and the people from minorities in your firm come into your firm every day from a world that treats them differently. And if you aren't showing them that that's not going to be the same experience, then of course they will presume it will be the same experience.
Okay, thank you very much. Heather.
Absolutely. I think, you know, as has been said, building a more diverse and inclusive workplace is a strategic imperative for investment management and for Capital Group, where I work. I know we'll spend more time talking about the data today. The good news, as Jill alluded to, is it's unequivocal. Diversity leads to healthier companies and better results for investors in our case. I think the bad news is we're not where we need to be in investment management, and we've got to get this right. The point that I want to make, though, is why I think it's so urgent right now, and why I think the focus needs to be on flexibility in particular. If you step back and you look at the data from 2015 until the pandemic hit in February of this year, women's increasing participation in the workforce was the primary driver of the global economic expansion that we were all witnessing. That came to an abrupt halt in February of 2020. And at that point, we saw a sudden drop in women's participation in the workforce, with the biggest drops for lower income women, racially and ethnically diverse women, and single mothers. All that progress that we had seen, unprecedented progress over the last 5 years, is now being wiped out as we speak. And at the center of that are issues around childcare being disproportionately, those responsibilities being disproportionately saddled by women as schools have closed and childcare facilities and the like. In the US, we've never truly built a workplace for people with caregiving responsibilities. And I think that's one of the biggest opportunities we have in front of us. And that's going to absolutely require men and women. Men have to be part of the solution. We will all have to model flexible work arrangements. We're going to have to all model gender equivalent maternity and paternity leaves and inclusive leadership if we're going to build a workplace that allows for a broader group of employees to thrive.
Okay, Heather, and we will absolutely touch on some of those points later. But Robin, if I could just come back to you on the question about how important it is to get men involved and also what is the most meaningful, tangible thing that companies can do to actually get men to the table for this?
Thank you so much, Laura. To build on what my other panelist had said, I think it's really important to talk about the perception gap. Tiernan touched on this, that a study released earlier this year by Stanford Biodesign surveyed many working people, and 90% worked at a company where the majority of the leadership were men. Only 36% of the women who were surveyed said that they agreed that their company, quote, empowers women to reach their fullest potential. But how do you think the men answered? The men at the same companies said that 80% of the men at those companies said that their companies empower women to reach their fullest potential. So 80 and 36. The men are not recognizing the reality of the barriers or the discrimination or the realities that their colleagues face. And so together we have to close this perception gap because it's also an empathy gap. The savviest leaders, men or women, recognize the power of leadership and sponsorship to their own influence and their own ability to create impact. And that equality for everyone doesn't mean less for men, it means more for everybody. And then those who aren't savvy enough to realize that are actually going to get left behind.
So do you think that when you look at the gap between how men perceive the workplace and how women perceive it, is it simply that men don't see it how it is, or is there an element of, well, the status quo actually suits men quite well, therefore they're happy not to look at the things that they don't want to look at?
Well, it might be the case. But like others said, I think if we can assume the best of intentions and the best of desires that the both the women and the men that we work with are all for equality, a lot of it comes to actually being able to be exposed to the realities of what people who don't have the same experiences you have, and actively putting yourself in that position. But those of us who run the programs and think about how to include other people want to make sure that we give everybody the opportunity. So one of the best choices we made at Bridgewater was to make our affinity groups open to everybody. So there's not just a social gathering of like people, it's that the affinity groups, whether it's the women's network that I co-founded and helped to run, or the Bridgewater Black Network, or Be Proud, or our Hispanic and Latinx network, they put on events, and we all put on events that benefit the whole firm and help to create a better shared experience that can create and help to close that empathy gap.
Got it. Thank you. I'll just come to Heather now.
Yeah, at the point that I wanted to add into the conversation, there was an interesting piece of work done last year by the Center for Talent Innovation. And what they did is they surveyed college-educated white men, and where they were specifically assessing their level of support for corporate D&I agendas. And then they segmented the respondents into three categories: detractors, true believers, and persuadables. And to your question, only 10% were actual detractors. 40% of white college-educated men are true believers, and 50% were persuadable. And to me, this really speaks to the power of nurturing a strong base of supporters and focusing on those who are persuadable versus focusing on a minority of folks who may be detractors.
Yeah. Got it. And sorry, Jill, I think you wanted to jump in there as well.
Yeah, on this group that's persuadable and to the points that were just made, I think some of it is just being able to walk in someone else's shoes. I mean, we've built a robust affinity group at McKinsey around dual career couples, couples that are, you know, both pursuing professional pursuits outside the home. And, you know, I'm one of the founders of this. And part of the reason I founded it is one day I was in the elevator coming up to the office in the days when we all met in the office. And one of my colleagues, you know, was very frazzled, a male colleague. And he said, oh, I had to get my daughter off to school and I had to do her ponytail. And it's been such a long morning. And he's going on and on. And I literally looked at him and I said, that's my day every day. And, you know, he was so in his own moment that he didn't really appreciate that there were so many of us coming to the office every day. And I put men and women in that bucket, in this dual career couples who had childcare or other caregiving responsibilities who experienced that life all the time. And I think putting it back to him, like, yeah, I understand your wife's away, but that's not your normal existence. Yeah. But for the many of us, it is, was a real aha moment. That elevator ride. And so I think it's for this persuadable group, it's just creating those aha moments. I mean, we had a lot of them over the summer on the back of the racial inequality protests, where many of us realized, myself included, we don't know what it's like to walk in the shoes of people from different backgrounds. And I think we need to do the same for men when they want to think about how to support women.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tiernan, were you jumping in there?
Yeah, no, I'm going to agree with it. I mean, that I think the persuadable piece is really important, because I think sometimes campaigns, and it's really tempting, we focus on this hardcore of opposition, but it's a lot smaller than we think. And campaigns love doing it because it's where all the sound and fury is, and you'll get more Twitter followers, and I'll be more popular if I say something outrageous. But they're not moving, and more importantly, they're not the game. The game is buildings full of people who genuinely would be horrified to think that they were discriminating. But they haven't got to that point of going, I do need to reinforce this all the time. And, you know, I think the point about the elevator conversation is really interesting, because it's, where do you create that space if you know that inclusion is what? That's the trigger moment when people start to understand, I need to be a better advocate for this. So how do we as companies create as many spaces as possible for that who conversion to happen, where it becomes Margaret and John and Joan and Janice, you know, and thinking about exactly, you know, from Lunch and Learns to reverse mentoring to all the different programs, but all geared towards making that space where people have the light bulb moment of going, I thought I was a good guy, but actually, passive non-discrimination is part of the problem. I need to actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did want to bring it into, so how much harder are these things to achieve in these kind of light bulb moments when we don't meet people in the elevators anymore, when we're all at home working in our offices, like in our kitchens, in our living rooms? How much harder is it to both have those lightning bolt moments and then also to try to persuade the persuadables when you can't gather them all in a room or do the kind of things that you would typically do?
Who wants to go with that?
Robin, I think I saw your hand first, so we'll take Robin and then we'll take Heather.
Well, I think a big thing is that leadership has to come from the top on this. And so in a world where we're not together and you're not running into people in the hallways or you're not having these organic gatherings, and it research does suggest that this will mostly affect or more affect people who are newer in their career or for people from underrepresented groups, either women or people of color, that are going, or people who have greater childcare responsibilities, like we've already talked about, which tends to fall more often on the women, that are going to have it a lot harder in this remote environment. And those, how do you create the opportunity for organic connections and to be connected to the broader mission? So one of the things at Bridgewater we've done is our CEO, David McCormick, will host a every other week video conference call for the whole company. And we didn't really do this before the quarantine and the lockdown, but having an opportunity where at least 80% of the company is joining to have a conversation about our mission, our clients, our company, and our future, and an Ask Me Anything type forum where people are modeling the behavior of how do we connect. And then those affinity groups that I talked about, which are open to everybody, are also creating these dynamic engagements on what's happening in our business, and not just what's happening for women's issues, but also, you know, our most senior investors, some of our most senior investors are women. And so them leading conversations on what's, you know, what we're doing in our portfolios or what we're doing for our clients, and doing that for the whole company can actually create that an employee can have between 5 and 10 meaningfully new virtual experiences that they wouldn't actually have had in our normal pre-COVID time.
Thanks very much, Robin. And Heather, I think you guys have had some experience with holding some virtual events around some of this through the pandemic, which has gone quite well for you by all accounts.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I couldn't agree more with the sentiment that Robin was sharing. We've had a similar experience at Capital Group with our communities really taking the lead on this and hosting over the summer a number of what I would characterize as open dialogue sessions for the organization, where we at one point, you know, they started fairly organically with 50 people. At one point, it was 500 people dialing in and listening and learning and having dialogue around some of these issues. So incredibly important platform that arose organically and is something that we're going to continue in the future. One other point I wanted to make was part of what's cut through with the persuadables is around the notion of value versus values. And, you know, for me, part of my responsibility is looking after ESG, and I see a really interesting corollary between D&I and how we think about that as a firm and some of the conversations I have in the marketplace around ESG. And what I mean is, you know, I find it can be challenging. ESG can be a challenging topic with clients until I say I'm going to focus on value, not values. And what I mean by that is, as an asset manager, it's our responsibility to generate returns for investors. We want to get any edge we can in doing that. And that's how we create value. And that makes sense to folks. And if that's additional data or more diverse team, we jump on it and that resonates with clients. I think it's inherently easier when we talk about what we share and have in common. And in investment management, that's all around creating value for our clients. It gets challenging when we debate these topics on moralistic grounds. That will resonate with some, but not all. And the minute that we talk about creating value versus debating values, we found it's much easier to win over even the most hardened skeptic. And I found that to be true of ESG and D&I.
Thank you, that's really interesting. Something else I did want to touch on, a lot of the issues that have come up around the pandemic work environment in particular seem to relate to parents rather than to men versus women in some cases. Is there an argument for trying to reframe some of the conversations around making workplaces parent friendly rather than making them women friendly? Yeah, Jill?
So I certainly am a huge advocate of the dual career couples, as I mentioned, and talking about helping caregivers overall. And caregivers don't just have to be parents, but people who have elderly family members, the old family members. I mean, very expansive view of what it means to be a caregiver. But I do want to say the burden of maintaining an acceptable workforce for women, I think, has never been more critical. I mean, McKinsey's been tracking this data for the last 6 years with the Lean In Foundation. And this year, for the first time, we see a notable difference between women anticipating leaving the workforce at a rate much more significant than men. So 1 in 4 women report that they are likely to attrite from the workforce or scale back dramatically what they're doing in the next 4 months. Now, I don't know if that will come to pass, but it's notable in that it's more than men saying they're going to do it. And if it were to come to pass, it represents 2 million women opting out or scaling back from the workforce, which is the equivalent of 1 year of graduates of U.S. Colleges and graduate women, female graduates. And so, you know, I do think getting it right for women who are reporting a not just a double shift, but a double shift in terms of the number of hours they're spending at home relative to their male colleagues at home who are also parents. Maintaining the home in COVID is significant. So yes, I'd like to reframe so that it's about all parents, but I also want to make it very clear, women are feeling this burden much more acutely And I don't want to lose sight of that, or else we'll wipe out a generation of women in the workforce, which I don't think any of us say is the right thing.
Yeah, because those figures that you quoted are very discouraging, obviously, from a women in the workforce perspective. I've heard mixed accounts of how women are being affected by the pandemic, because there is that, but then also some companies would argue that there is a more flexible approach to work across the board, which could actually make it easier for women in the workforce. So are you guys getting any sense that the current working environments could actually make it easier for women to progress? Tiernan, I think I see you there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is a bit of both, because I think there's two things happening. There's what women are experiencing right now, and what happens as a result afterwards from the learning of this experience. And one of them is an instant duty of care requirement. We need to be minding people so they don't have to make, you know, choices between career and life that they shouldn't have to. And we know that that is disproportionately affecting women, because until we live in the, you know, the perfect world, there is still an imbalance in care responsibility and family structures, and, you know, pretty much in all societies. So there's that bit. But I think the other bit that's going to follow on from that is, yes, you know, the flexibility that we've seen happen overnight was incredible. And that opens potential, but only potential for change. And that's about us being smart now and thinking, what's the infrastructural reform we need to embed? Because we know what will happen. We'll all go back to work as soon as someone tells us we go back to work. And if we haven't thought, strategized, and put in proper infrastructural change, we'll be back in the old way as quickly as we blink. You know, because it's just human nature. We'll just slide back into it. We'll have leadership saying, greater flexibility is going to happen. And then we'll have the next layer of management going, yeah, but not in this team. He didn't mean it for everyone. He didn't mean it for everyone. It's just for everyone else. This team's going to still be expecting you to come in and do your presenteeism and your 50 hours. So now's the moment where we have to actually do what you're asking, Laura, which is if we want those benefits, and we've had a peek at them during this moment, if we want them to live on, then what we really have to do is now start engaging internally, going infrastructural reform, new policies and procedures, have them bedded and ready to go on day one. Because wait till day five, you know what's going to happen.
That's quite depressing, but yes, probably true. Heather, I think you wanted to jump in there as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think two points I would add. On the data front, the reality is today, a third of working women ages 25 to 44 who are unemployed cite childcare as the primary reason for their unemployment. That's more than triple the rate of men. So this is disproportionately and adversely affecting women today. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more with the point of the promise that we have, right? The silver lining of the work from home environment is that many of us find ourselves in an opportunity, what's probably a once in a lifetime opportunity to reset our norms, to incorporate regular work flexibility as a realistic and effective option for our teams. But this isn't going to be easy. And as Tiernan said, we have to, you know, redefine what flexibility means. We're going to have to establish expectations and responsibilities and get that infrastructure in place now. And I think we all have an important role to play in modeling this as a normative option in the future. Anything less, we lose the promise of this opportunity.
Thanks, Heather. I'm going to come to Robin now.
Heather, I think that's so well said. And just building on your point, that the modeling is also going to have to come from the people in power. So we all can monitor it. But in a world where if you're working in a male-dominated company, industry, country, whatever, the people who have to recognize the points that we've all been making about how this is disproportionately affecting women are going to be the ones who have to put themselves in that position of empathy to recognize what it's going to be like. For if the schools are closed and there's remote learning and I'm supposed to be in the office, it's not going to work. Who is that going to fall to? And if we as leaders, and specifically the people who don't feel that burden, understand it and put themselves in that position, I think that's the only way that we're going to make a difference.
Thank you. So that brings me to our first viewer question of the day, which ties into this tangentially. So the questioner asks, the Black Lives Matter protests have rightly taken center stage this year. Has that diverted attention enough to set gender equality back? or taking a change of taking a theory of change approach, how can we harness that to better drive change on both agendas? Who would like to take that?
I can have a go at it. I mean, no is the answer. I think at any given moment, in swings and roundabouts, different parts of inclusion are going to get different, different moments of focus. If anything, it has amplified how important the whole area of inclusion and equality is. You know, it's that, terrible old political cliche, a rising tide can, lifts all boats, but it's true on this one. And I think if anything, it has shone a light on inclusion, but I think it's shone a light on something really important for all of us as well as we think about how we create this change in our workplace. I think we had a lot of people who would, like to think of themselves as good people, but just didn't know how to reach out to each other and learn from each other during the Black Lives Matter moment. And it wasn't that they didn't care, it's that they were worried about having the language wrong, and the corporate culture does not smile on getting things wrong. So rather than get it wrong, don't do anything. So we have to work really hard at creating that active space of going, and I think Black Lives Matter really taught us this, you got to make space where people can become advocates, not experts. And that's a reversal of what the corporate world normally makes you feel like. But it's going to be the real gateway that Black Lives Matter have taught us.
Thank you, Jordan. That's quite optimistic, at least. Jill?
Yeah, and I think what we learned from Black Lives Matter is, we need to continue to facilitate diversity trainings, allyship discussions. I mean, the conversation around bringing affinity groups, being open to all, I think we learned from Black Lives Matter as an important piece of the puzzle. I also think, if we look at where Black women fit into this, they report being an only far more than anyone else, any other population of men or Black men or women overall. And so supporting the Black women, I think, helps, again, lift all tides in the sense of, making them feel included. And so, I agree with Karen. This is about diversity overall and having a diverse workforce, which, leads to, in many cases, up to 50% better performance in terms of overall corporate performance. And so we need diversity in all fronts. I certainly don't see it as a setback for women at all. I think it just rises further up the top of the agenda as being important for everyone.
Yeah, so it sounds as if gains for one group don't come at the expense of a different group.
Not in my experience.
Sorry. No. So that we do have 2 minutes left. We do have a minute or so left if we have any additional audience questions. Just want to put that out there. It's very hard when you can't see the hands. So I think we are good for audience questions. So we've got about a minute and a half left. Any final thoughts then on what people who are listening to this session can do from a concrete perspective to try to improve diversity in their firms? We'll have about 20 seconds each if anyone would like to start. So we will start with Jill.
Yeah, I think there's a few things. Maybe I'll make three recommendations. I think we need to lock in this flexibility. People who have flexibility are more satisfied at work, likely to stay longer and be more satisfied and productive at work. I think we need to take a close look at performance reviews, de-bias performance reviews, and particularly focus on outputs as opposed to inputs. Stop evaluating the number of hours in the day, but more what is the output of someone's contribution. And we need to continue to have the conversation around how to be a good ally, what does it mean to have diversity on your teams, and continue to train people on being an unbiased leader.
Great. Thank you very much, Jill. And Robin, what can people do, do you think? What's your concrete advice to people?
Well, I think it really comes down to empathy and generosity. And so to recognize that any one of us, man or woman or anybody, can play one of three roles at any point in time: the person who's in the position of the most power and the most privilege, the bystander or the ally, and third, the person with less, the person who needs the reach out and the advocate to help somebody. And people often expect that I'm always going to be the champion of diversity in that moment if I'm the head of the Women's Network or on the Diversity Inclusion Council. But actually, a lot of times, I'm the one who's in the position of having the most power and privilege in the room. And how do I think about how I do that for my team and model my own example and not just blame everybody else for it? In the same way as if I go into my next meeting and I could be the most junior person in the room and I need to look for who's my sponsor and who's my allies. Yeah. And everybody's thinking about empathy and generosity and how, what is the role and having the self-awareness to know what's the role that they're playing in that moment.
Thanks very much, Robin. Now we are into extra time, so I'm going to ask Heather and Tiernan to be super brief, but Heather, what are your concrete pieces of advice?
Super brief, two of them. One, seize the once in a lifetime opportunity we have to solidify more flexible work-life environment for all of us. So that's one. And then two, I think we each have a role to play in thinking about how we unlock the promise of diversity by building a more inclusive environment and specifically thinking about the value of diversity in the business processes and decisions that we're each responsible for.
Okay, thank you so much. And Tiernan, very, very briefly. Or they'll kill me.
I agree with everything everybody said, which, you know, summation it that way. Heather's pretty brilliant. What I would say is for the guys, very quickly, if we had one takeaway for them, a value that you keep in your head is a secret. If you believe in these things, if you believe in equality and fairness, you have to actively demonstrate it all the time. You'll be rewarded for it. The culture will be rewarded for it. But don't leave it in your head thinking that people are going to presume you're a good guy. Show them you're a good guy.
And that is an excellent note to finish up on, Tiernan. Thank you so much for that. Thank you to all of our panelists for taking part. And thank you to everyone at home, in their offices, wherever you guys are, for tuning in today to watch.